Hi, this is Dr. Michelle Woolhouse. Join us on FX Medicine next week, where we'll be talking to Dr. Kristen Neff about the science of self-compassion and how we can use it to help both ourselves and our patients. Subscribe to us on your favourite podcast app and follow us on social media to make sure you never miss an episode. Welcome to FX Medicine, bringing you the latest in evidence-based, integrative, functional, and complementary medicine. I'm Dr. Michelle Woolhouse. FX Medicine acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia, where we live and work, and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to the elders, past and present, and extend this respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today. In every one of us, there is a dichotomy. A side of us that is scared and self-focused, and another side that is expansive and interconnected with things beyond ourselves. It seems much of this contrast is found in how our brain works. At the age of 29, Dr. Jill Bolt Taylor's life changed forever. A left-sided hemorrhagic stroke over 4 hours significantly damaged the left side of her brain. In those 4 hours, she lost her ability to speak, walk, write, read, or recall any details of her life. And at the same time, it felt amazing. Dr. Jill, a Harvard-based neuroanatomist at the time, she was awestruck with the ability to witness a somewhat fascinating event. What she experienced, her recovery, and her insights have made a huge impact on our understanding of the intimately interconnected but vastly distinctive roles of the left and right sides of the brain. I was so struck by her internal observations that I shared her story in the pages of my book, The Wonder Within. Dr. Jill Bolt Taylor, welcome, Jill.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Jill, I was one of the 29 million viewers of your TED Talk. Where you shared such an incredible story told with incredible curiosity and intelligence. Can you take us through that story briefly in case our listeners are not familiar?
Sure. So I grew up to study the brain because I have a brother who's been diagnosed with a brain disorder, schizophrenia. And he's only 18 months older than I, so everything we did together. And as a child, I didn't know that there could be something wrong with his brain. All I knew was that he was different from me. And so I became very curious about how is it that we can have the exact same experience, but walk away with different interpretations of what happened. So I really tuned into body language and facial language and just, you know, this curiosity of what am I as a living being? Mm. And so I grew up to study the brain, became a neuroanatomist, and I was teaching and performing research at Harvard Medical School. And I woke up one day and I was experiencing a major hemorrhage in the left half of my own brain. So through the eyes of a curious scientist, I got to watch over the course of 4 hours, my brain deteriorate to the point that I could not walk, talk, read, write, or recall any of my life. And I essentially became an infant in a woman's body. Mm. And through the eyes of a scientist, it was very exciting. Because I got
that
to
part
watch.
I find amazing.
You know, you would probably find it very interesting as well, because it's like all of a sudden I'm experiencing what I have studied in books.
Wow.
And here it is, you know, my life. And then they saved me, and it took 8 years for me to completely, consciously rebuild my brain one circuit at a time, one ability at a time, in order to regain the circuits that I had lost or were wounded because of the stroke.
What's so amazing, I think, about your recovery story, because the TED Talk talks about the event and this extraordinary, I guess, polarity that you experienced. And I want to get to that in a minute. But in terms of your recovery as well, like, what was the moment? How did you start something like that? Like, how did you, you know, you mentioned kind of one circuit at a time. Like, did you know where to begin? How did that occur?
Well, I began where I was, and I was completely detached from my body. My body felt like a lump of lead that I couldn't begin to move. And, you know, it was as though I had no two neurons communicating with one another. But all I had, but I was still conscious, and I was conscious in the present moment. I had no perception of a past or a future, even though I knew that I had been able to do those things. And it's kind of like I was so disconnected from the reality that I'd had before, but I still had some perception of what that reality had been because it was ingrained in both of my hemispheres, and I only lost the left hemisphere. So I began with, you know, I couldn't move. And so it was like, okay, well, can I move? You know, can I, these parts, these, you know, these pieces are of me. Can I get the energy of my conscious mind to get to those distal parts so that when people would come in and squeeze my hand and say, squeeze my hand, and I'd look at them like, can't you tell I got a problem over here? and you know, and they do is come in and squeeze my hand, and it's like I didn't understand language. I didn't know what a hand was. I didn't know what a squeeze was. And what was communicated to me was that the external world has no idea whatsoever how to help me get back any function. And so it was clear that this was going to be up to me. And I just started with, you know, any sense of awareness in relationship to my body. And I realized that I could do three things. I could try to movement. Which was behavior. I could try to think a thought and hold on to an idea long enough to, you know, dwell on it. And I could experience emotion, and that was all that was going on. And it was like I only had X amount of energy, and I would spend that energy. And once the energy was spent, I had to go back to sleep. So I really learned that I needed to refuel, and refueling myself had to become a priority. And as we look at how we humans live our lives, in most communities, sleep is not a priority. And when I look at the lack of mental health in humanity as a whole, I think a lot of it has to do with we don't get enough sleep.
No. Don't get enough rest either, I don't think. Because your new book, Whole Brain Living, is incredible. And I couldn't put it down, and I read it from start to finish. And it's always one of those books I know a successful book for me when I have a highlighter and I basically turn the book pink pretty quickly. Tell us about the left and right-hand side of the brain and how different are they? I mean, I know you experienced such a juxtaposition through your stroke experience. Is this something that humans just have, this right and left-hand side of the brain, or do all animals share this polarity?
All animals do share this level of polarity. And we thought that it was only humans that had these differences between what's going on in the right brain and the left brain. But all sorts of research, and if you're interested in research, there's a wonderful book called The Master and His Emissary. The Master and His
Amazing.
Emissary.
Amazing.
Ian McGilchrist.
I saw Ian McGilchrist speak a year ago, and which kind of tracked me to your book effectively. And I just I was enamored. It was incredible. It's an incredible book. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yes, I love his work. He has essentially taken the last 70 years of basic science. What have people learned about birds and reptiles and mammals at the level of just raw basic research. Mm. And combined it into this tome of information. And it's a beautiful book if people like to read that kind of thing. And so the two hemispheres, to me, at the level of our human brain, the biggest difference between the two hemispheres from my perspective of what happened to me is the right hemisphere is the right here, right now, immediate information processing machine. So all this information is streaming in through my sensory system, and I'm having an experience of what I'm seeing, what I'm smelling, what I'm tasting, the position of my body in space, et cetera. So that's all the immediacy of the present moment. The left hemisphere takes the information of the present moment and compares it to our past experience. So there are these amazing cells in the left hemisphere, in the emotional system tissue of our left hemisphere, that actually has the ability to step out of the present moment. Now, just as a biological thinker, how on earth does that happen? I mean, think about the miracle of us being alive, first of all, but us being alive and having the capacity to have a past, a present, and a future. I mean, this is mind-blowing science.
It is. So what is the biological reason of why they're divided, and what's the role of the corpus callosum? Like, and you know, because obviously there's, you know, I remember looking at, I think it was in your book, as well as I love medical anthropology of, like, we used to cut people's corpus callosums, you know, in for epilepsy and all realms of different health conditions that we thought that was a good idea back maybe 80 years ago. So what is the biological reason why they're so divided?
Well, I think that the two hemispheres and the way they provide us with information is, first of all, if I'm an animal and I'm functioning in the present moment and just the present moment, that's great for immediacy, but I have to be able to learn. And learning, in order to have learning, I have to be able to take information from the past and evaluate and reflect upon it based on information coming in the present moment. Mm. So if we're going to be able to learn new things, which is what we are as you know, this magnificent combination of cells, I have to have linearity across time. Yeah. So I can reflect upon what I've already learned, compare what I've learned with the new stimulation coming in, so I know if I'm safe or not.
Mm.
And having these two very different ways of looking at the world, the big picture, I need to have the big picture in order to have possibility and hope and joy, again, in the present moment. And I need to have the left hemisphere in order to have the language, in order to have the ability to sequence, have linearity across time, in order to learn and to grow based upon the information that I've had. And then the role of that corpus callosum is to bring it all together so that it functions so fluidly that I have the perception that I just have a way of being, but it's really this magical combination of these different ways of perceiving.
So I loved in your book that you divided the brain into four different areas, but you also gave them distinctive personalities, and you encourage your reader to get to know each one and even to name them. I loved your character of Helen, who you lost through your stroke, is that right? And take us through your different personalities of your different sides of the brains, and give us some insights into the characters that reside in inside your beautiful head.
So when you look at the anatomy of the brain, there were creatures that had the level of sophistication of just the vertebra, and a little bit of brain stem of the medulla acted like a brain to bring all those different levels of the vertebra together as a thing. And then new information adds on top of it at the level of the pons. And as the pons comes on, we start having automaticity of some of our function. We breathe automatically. We have different desires and things that are happening at that level of on-off switches of essentially a reptilian brain. And then you add new tissue on top of that, and we end up with the emotional tissue, the limbic tissue. So we have limbic emotional tissue in the right hemisphere, which gives us an experience. What does it feel like to be in my body? What does it feel like in the present moment when I jump into the water and I feel the cool water against and the pressure of the water against my body? And then we also have limbic emotion in the left hemisphere, which gives me the deeper emotions based on my past experience. So all of my past pain, my emotional past pain, is located in the left hemisphere emotional tissue. Well, that personality, if I'm feeling jealous or rage or anger or fear, or I feel like I'm not worthy, or I'm feeling self, any of that stuff, those cells do. If you wipe out those cells, then you don't feel those things anymore. I mean, the beauty of the brain is that every ability we have is because we have a very specific group of cells in the brain that, because they perform that function, we have that ability. And when I wiped out my left hemisphere with the hemorrhage, then I lost all my pain from the past because those cells went offline. So we have, but generally in the normal brain, then we have the emotions from the past, including anxiety and fear of the future. We have in the right hemisphere, the emotional experience. What does it feel like to be in my body? What does it feel like? And then add on top of that for humans, this beautiful thinking tissue. So I think in my left hemisphere, which is my rational, organizational. It has a past and a future. It thinks sequentially. It creates language. It has numbers. It's my organizer, my categorizer. It likes to be the boss. It's my A-type personality.
That was Helen. You named your character Helen.
That's Helen.
Yeah.
I named her Helen because she's a real hell on wheels. She gets it done. So, and then the right hemisphere, the right thinking tissue, is again in the present moment, but it's the collective whole. It's connected to all that is. And in that level of consciousness, I have the ability to experience the awe of, oh my gosh, I'm alive, and this intense gratitude that I'm a biological creature capable of all these things simply because I'm human. And in that awe comes a natural grace and a natural desire to nurture others and support others and to love all life on the planet, because we're all the same thing. We're all life on the planet. That's just this incredible gift. So each of these four different groups of cells ends up with giving us very specific skill sets, and those skill sets package themselves together and they come out looking behaviorally like personalities. So we all have these four groups of cells if we have relatively normal neuroanatomy, and we can actually learn to identify and differentiate these four different characters inside of ourselves and in others. And what that really means is that if there's four characters inside of me who I can get to know and I can actually bring them into conversation with one another, and every other person has these four characters, that means in every relationship between two people, there's actually eight of us. And when you stop and you think about how complex our interrelations are, wow, whole brain living really helps us better understand who's who inside of each of us.
And it's beautiful. It's a beautiful way, because as you're speaking, I'm thinking, you know, of Richard Schwartz's works of looking at the different parts, which is a lot of synergy with this neuroanatomical way of looking at the brain and personality and the fullness of our life. And also, when we look at the research on mindfulness and meditation, we're often really encouraged to look at the somatic feeling, which is obviously, you know, it seems to me that a lot of the problems with the Western world is we're just using the left-hand side of our brain so much more dominantly than the right-hand side of our brain, which is a lot more nuanced, present moment, and kind of where we're missing the interconnection. What's your understanding of that?
I agree completely. I think that the conscious value of the right hemisphere that is right here, right now, it does not define me, the individual. So it's not about me and my ego. It's about me as a biological creature in the world. And when I come into this world as based on the value of us as a collective whole, my behavior changes. And it's different than if I come into the world as a left brain dominant character, where I am an individual, I am separate from you. And as soon as I'm separate from you, now I have me and mine, and I want more for me and mine. And I become familial based, tribe based. It's about us versus they. And the value structure is I want more, I want to win, and I want, and if I win, it's a zero sum game. If one of us will win, the other one will lose, and therefore I'm going to come at you against you instead of the right hemisphere, which is going to come into the world and figure out this planet in this life together as a we.
And I think your experience, you know, your somatic experience of what you went through allows you to have almost like what I sense through watching the TED talk is just this knowing that will never ever leave you now of this incredible interconnection, the oneness of life. You talk about this, you know, this bliss point of being just in the right hemisphere, and obviously, you know, you didn't have very many skills alongside of that, including speech and the ability to move, but yet there was this lack of fear and this awe-expanding interconnection. Tell us what that felt like.
Well, it felt as though I was at one with all that is, whatever that is. But as I go into the bigger picture, I lose my focus on the detail. And as I lose the focus on the detail, I lose the focus on me as the individual, because my ego sets me up to be one of those details. And the details of my life, when I allow those to relax and I shift away from the importance of me, the individual, I shift into the overall consciousness of I am this magnificent anatomical creation of the universe, and I am connected to that both energetically and molecularly. And it doesn't matter if I'm a single-celled organism that has simply a semi-permeable membrane stippled with receptors, and this cell is separate from the whole to a point where I, the individual cell, can experience what's going on around me. And, you know, at the beginning of this is, you know, how does consciousness, you know, titillate itself with, you know, being able to sense receptor. But I'm not a single-celled organism. I'm a cellular structure that is multicellular to the level of some 50 trillion cells that have differentiated themselves, so have all these capacities as a human being. And when one really reflects upon that with awe, there's this sense of immense gratitude and love for life, my life, your life, that we have life at all. So that's what it feels like. It's that feeling of elation that we can experience when we stop thinking about all those details about me, the individual, mine, us, and all the details of the world. It's like forget the external and just go into this awe of magnificence.
Amazing. I loved in your book too, in that you had this beautiful reframe about emotions. So often, you know, not for everyone, but obviously sometimes we've got an interesting relationship with our emotions. Like we kind of think of emotions as either positive or negative, which, you know, I don't think is a very helpful thing. And some people think that emotions are a little bit irrelevant or wasting of time. But you have a really beautiful reframe about the role of emotions, particularly since your brain injury. Can you share with us what that is and how this new approach to your, to I guess, developing a new relationship with your emotions changed the way you view the world?
Well, first of all, at a biological level, if we go back to the evolution of the mammalian nervous system, the limbic emotional tissue, there are creatures mammals, that's what they have. The limbic emotional tissue is what separates a mammal from a reptile. And so, and there are a lot of differences then that emotional tissue brings. And us as mammals, then we have that emotional tissue, and then information, new cells get added on top to be able to regulate and refine the emotional tissue below it. But as human beings, information streams in through the sensory systems, and it passes first through the emotional limbic tissue. And then from there, it goes up into the higher thinking cortex. And what that means is we are feeling creatures who think. We are feeling creatures who think instead of thinking creatures who feel. Mm. So when we choose to relate more to our thinking, because we're trained that, oh, it's wrong to be emotional, or all these negative things about being emotional or whatever, we're driving this top-down system that is not designed to flow from the top down. Top down is for moderation. It's not for elimination. So we need to be able to feel our emotions, whether they're in the right brain, right here, right now, the experience, what does the experience feel like inside of our bodies, but also to be able to reflect upon our emotions that are stirred up from our past. And we have to be able to do that. We have to be able to have a relationship and reflect upon the pain from our past so that we can evaluate it and understand it so that we can move through it and grow from it. And we grow from it by reflecting upon it and learning about ourselves in relationship to that circuitry. So we have to have a relationship with our emotions from the past if we're going to grow into the future. And you had mentioned IFS and the internal family systems programming, where they look at different parts. And the kind of the biggest difference between whole brain living and IFS, in my opinion, is that IFS focuses a lot on the different parts inside of that, what I call character two left emotional tissue. It divides it up in two different parts, and then some of the parts actually come in as character one, as like the protectors.
Yes.
But for me, three quarters of the brain is very healthy. Character one, our rational left thinking brain, it without emotion, by definition, without the emotion, not driven by the emotion, simply being rational, it's a very healthy part of who we are. Yeah. And our right hemisphere, character four, which is love for all that is, that's a very healthy part of who we are. And character three, the right emotional part of who we are, is simply experiential of the awareness in the present moment as a part of the collective whole. So it's a very healthy part of us. So if we go, you know, if we have problems, and of course we all do, but it's usually the conflict inside of our own little character two tissue. And whole brain living can train us to know what our choices is. The title of the book is Whole Brain Living, The Anatomy of Choice and the Four Characters That Drive Our Life. So when we can differentiate these four different characters, then we know what our choices are so that if I move into my character two and I it's my pain and I need to I need to save myself, rescue my own way of being in a moment, I have my characters one, three, and four right there all together in order to help me pull out of the pain that can be unhealthy if I'm driven toward self-hurt in any way or aggression towards others, so whatever's going on inside of there, so that I can then approach that part of me with love and affection and value what the lessons are for me to learn, other than just letting that character too lash out and be destructive to my relationships or to me.
Yeah, and it's beautiful, actually. I mean, what you were saying before about how you recovered from that stroke, and you know, as you were speaking, I was thinking, you know, like we've all, as you say, we've all got pain from our past, and we've all got stories that we repeat on over and over about, you know, things that occurred to us. But we all have this ability to kind of watch and see that we've got more options available, and just slowly, slowly making those changes, like neuron to neuron to neuron, like circuit to circuit, as you said, like you just had to make these micro connections right at the beginning. So I loved that the way that you see things is obviously so unique through the filter of your neuroanatomy, which is just really beautiful. But I wanted, one of my favorite things, and I know that you know this so deeply, and this matches on to what we were just talking about, and I feel like it's probably one of the most empowering things that I took, was your 90-second rule. Take us through the 90-second rule, because 90 seconds is not very long, although it sometimes feels like it at the time. Tell us about what you mean by this 90-second rule and what's going on neurologically and at a brain chemistry level.
So the 90-second rule is essentially, at any moment in time, there are really only three things going on inside of our brains. What the cells are doing. They are thoughts. We're thinking thoughts. We are feeling emotions, depending on which tissue is being run. And we are running a physiological response in our body to what we're thinking and what we're feeling. That's pretty much all that is ever really going on inside of the brain. And so if we look at a reflexive emotional loop, let's say, every time I'm in the presence of someone, they did me wrong 20 years ago, and now every time I think of that person, I become angry again, just like I did 20 years ago. And so I think the thought, and then I stimulate this emotional circuit, and then the emotional circuit results in a physiological response, and I get a furrow in my brow, I clamp my jaw, my chest gets tight, and I'm not breathing deeply, and I'm just angry again. And from the moment I think the thought to the moment I have, and then when I'm having that physiological response, that's because a chemistry has been dumped into my bloodstream and it floods through me. And then I have this constellation of events like the furrow in the brow, the clamped jaw, the constricted breath. From the moment I think the thought, I have the emotion, I have the physiological response, and then the physiological response floods through me and flushes out of my bloodstream, takes less than 90 seconds. So our emotional reactivity takes less than 90 seconds from a biological perspective. And but now everybody's saying, but Jill, I can stay angry for a whole lot longer than 90 seconds.
Weeks.
But the next time for weeks, for months, for decades, right?
Decades.
I can hold that grudge forever.
Totally.
And but what people need to think about is that watch yourself the next time you do that, because what you're doing is you're rethinking the thought and re-stimulating that trigger of that emotional loop. And you're rerunning that 90 seconds over and over and over again so that it builds up, builds up, builds up. But let's say all of a sudden the phone rings, right? And I'm over here thinking about that person and I'm not very happy and I'm rah, 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 rah. to myself, and then the phone rings, and it's like, so I pick up the phone, hello, you know, and then I'm distracted, right? So now that loop, that emotional loop, has been busted, and then I have my conversation, and then I hang up the phone. And it's in that instant is the moment I do my work, because my work is the choice. Do I go right back into that character too, rah, 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 or at that moment, do I feel like literally saved by the bell, and now I'm going to go be my character one and go to the office and organize my life? Or am I going to go for a walk in the woods and feel connected to the universe? Or am I going to go play with my dog and entertain my character three? And when I know what my four choices are, that's when I can make healthier choices.
So in my personal world, my anxiety journey was one of my most powerful learning and personal evolution events that I experienced, which is really clear that your stroke, you know, and your background in neuroanatomy was your pathway to personal growth. And you have a quote in your book, which is really, which was really profound, which said, "We have the power to choose moment by moment who and how we want to be in this world." And this profound statement obviously came through your struggles and challenges. From a neuroscience perspective, what was it about your experience that allowed you to come to this conclusion?
I think that as my brain began coming back online, my left brain, now this was an 8-year recovery process. So everyone says, well, how long did it take you to recover? And I say, well, recover what? Because if every ability I have is because I have brain cells that perform that function, then I might be able to sit up early on, but I might not be able to understand the concept of language for a couple of years. Or it was 4 years before I even understood what a one was when people would say to me, Joe, what's 1 + 1? So recovery for me was a long, arduous, slow, intense, moment-by-moment experience for literally 8 years, balanced with sleep. So I got to know my cells very well. I got to build relationships with these different parts of who I was. And what I realized was that there was a moment in time when my characters, when I had the hemorrhage, it was in the left hemisphere. And it wiped out my character one, rational organization, you know, the brain scientist fell off the ladder. And character two, all my pain from the past was erased. And so it was like, okay, so when those cells came collectively back online, I was actually water skiing, and water skiing, if any of you are water skiers, I was a slalom water skier when I was 7. So I was pretty good at it. And you know, you become at one with the ski in relationship to the water. And it's a beautiful experience. It was just a beautiful experience for my body. And so I actually got up on one ski, and the amount of effort that all of my cells have to go through in order to endure the first few moments when the boat pulls you and it's you against the water, and there's water spray everywhere, and then you plane on top. And so that happened for me. I became strong enough to get up. And then I realized, oh my gosh, I'm a solid again. I'm a solid. Wow. My perception of myself was no longer that I was a fluid, because for 8 years, in the absence of me, the individual, me as separate from the universe, my perception of myself was that I was a fluid in relationship to everything that's a fluid around me, because everything really is a fluid. But we, a tiny group of cells in the left hemisphere, perceives ourselves as a solid. And it was when I became the solid, I realized my character one was back. My character one was back. And she had been the boss of my life you know, I did climb on the Harvard ladder. She was good at what she did. She liked being the boss. She was a go, go, go girl. And she came back online and she essentially, I call her Helen, of course. And Helen comes back online and says, I'm back. Good work, girls. Now I want to be the boss again.
She wants to be the boss. Yeah.
And literally, and the rest of us, literally, our eyeballs just got really big, like, Helen, we're so glad you're back, but no, we don't want you to be the boss anymore. We don't want to live that life. We have different values now.
Wow.
And it was fascinating.
That's fascinating. I mean, it also, you know, that's what I find so fascinating about the brain of when you do some neurological healing, you know, and whether that's, you know, through anxiety management or for you through the physicality of a stroke, is that often those moments of interconnection, like when things come together, it's like one moment and it's like, boom, there she is, Helen, back again, etc. And off it kind of runs. And it's just such a beautiful way that you talk about it through your background of having this really distinct kind of personalities in these little areas of cells that you know so well. But I wanted to bring in, because you've got this gorgeous concept in your book called a brain huddle. And obviously you needed to get Helen into the brain huddle to make sure that she wasn't just taking over your life back again. What is a brain huddle for all of us? And can you give us some tips on how to do one?
So, yes, I think about the brain now. What did I know about the brain before versus what did I learn about the brain after this stroke and this recovery? And I kind of think about it as, you know, most of us think about our brain and we've got a brain and it's made up of all these cells. And it's kind of like, well, if you look at your hand and you say, okay, I have a hand and I can push things with the hand and I can pull things with the hand. But when I gain the level of dexterity, when I can differentiate between my different fingers, and once I can distinguish between my fingers and move those independently, now the hand becomes a completely different tool. Mm. And I can use those different fingers with different strengths and et cetera in different ways independently to do billions of things. And to me, that's the gift that we gain once we know our four characters. Because when we know our four characters, now someone can say to me, yeah, they can call me up and they can say, Jill, what are you doing? And they can tell immediately Helen, because Helen has this tone in her voice. And Helen sounds completely different than Pigpen, my character three. You know, and character two has a completely different voice than my character four, who really doesn't have much voice and probably isn't even ever going to answer the phone, right, if it rings, because she's already in her blissful euphoria having a moment. So as soon as we really get to know each of our four characters and we can begin to differentiate when are we being those different characters, and then I start looking at my partner or my children or my parents or my colleagues, and it's like all of a sudden their four characters are identifiable and they become predictable. And when we look at our interrelationships, like my character one, my character one loves to hang out with other people's character ones because, oh my God, when you put a bunch of character ones on a committee, we get a lot of stuff done. You know, boom, boom, boom. We rank it out, right? We all got the to-do list. We've done it in 2 days, even though it's not due for a month. I mean, you know, and then there are the visionaries who are over there who are literally on another planet. And it's like you want to get the visionary jobs, right? Because they're good at them and they'll do them because they enjoy that. And it really helps us in how we identify ourselves in relationship to others and others in relationship with us. So the brain huddle is a tool that we can use once we have identified our four characters, once we really know who they are, what do they feel like in our body, how do they hold our body, where do they come out? My, like, character one comes out in the office or on the phone. Character four comes out. She can come out anywhere at any time, and she's just different. Character three is going to be making a mess somewhere because she's always making a mess somewhere. That's what she does. She makes a mess. Whether it's in music or art or something physical, she's making a mess. And yeah. Character two, you know, that it's just more subdued. But anyway, once you get to know these four characters, bringing them into conversation with one another is vital. Because this is the power of who we are as human beings. And I truly believe this is the evolution of humanity. And as we mentioned earlier, we are so left brain driven and driven by the value structure of what's going on in characters one and two. But characters three and four is really where we're going to rescue humanity. And in order to rescue humanity, I help rescue humanity by getting to know my own four characters so I can purposely choose humanity values over just me and my values. So I then become a part of the solution instead of just an ongoing part of the problem. But the tool you mentioned is the brain huddle. But the goal is to get all four characters in conversation. The B stands for breath. It's an acronym. It stands for breath. And why? Bring your mind to the present moment, because I have to have a conversation with all of them in the present moment. R stands for recognize. Who was I when I called the brain huddle? Which of my four characters? And we should practice all four characters calling the brain huddle, because we need to call the huddle when we're in our little character two. And little character two needs to learn the value of rescuing our own self with the use of these three healthier parts of our brain, so that instead of just routinizing in that pain. So R, recognize who called the brain huddle. A, appreciate, it doesn't matter who called the brain huddle, really. There's four of us in here. And we're a team. And this is Team Jill. And Team Jill has Helen and Abby and Pigpen and Queen Toad. And that's my team. And at any moment, I can call on those, right? So A, appreciate, there's always four. I, inquire. In this moment, which one do I want to be? Now, in this moment, because I know my four characters so well, I can go look at the breeze going through the trees and get lost in the movement of the leaves as a character four connected to the big picture. I can very inappropriately say, gotta go, I gotta go paddleboard, and get rid of you and go and do something like paddleboard. Or I can become very sad instantaneously. I can think of the, you know, my mother, and I lost her and didn't lose her. She's floating around as a character four somewhere, I think, in the universe. But I can move myself into sadness or anger or grief or deep, deep, deep depression. I think we have the capacity to turn that circuitry on and off at will if we know how. Now, that's not to say that mental illnesses are not real, because they are. Severe mental illnesses are, but that's another whole conversation. Or I could choose to step into my character one and start giving you a list of what does B-R-A-I-N really stand for. So that's the inquiry. What do I want to be? I do have the power to choose moment by moment who and how I want to be in the world. And then N stands for navigate, because life is made up of moment after moment after moment. And so I'm navigating life as these four characters, choosing along the way who and how I want to be.
That's beautiful. And for anyone that didn't get that acronym, that stands for brain, which is obviously your favorite, you know, favorite part of the body to really understand it all. But I was really moved by the last line in your TED Talk, where you referred to the neural circuitry of the right side of the frontal lobe as the inner peace circuitry. And now that you've recovered, what are some of your go-to tools to help you strengthen this inner peace circuitry?
Well, I'm a little odd compared to who I was before. Mm-hmm. Because I live my life from that place, not from a character, not a left brain going to the right brain.
Yeah.
I live in the right brain, and I live my life going from that right brain into the left brain. So, for example, I give maybe, I don't know, 20 interviews in a month. But Helen, character one, my characters three and four said, I don't want an interview in the middle of the day because I'm a pig pen and I want to go out to the garage and I want to carve stone. Right. Or I want to go to the glass zone. And, you know, when I'm doing my art, I literally look like disheveled. Right. Of course I do. And so I don't want to have to stop, go and bathe and get clean and decent again in order to be able to have a conversation. So I have Helen package all my interviews in a week. And it makes for a very busy week. But because Helen gets her week, I get the other three. You know
Brilliant.
What I mean? So I prioritize my time of my right brain bliss. I've created this balance for myself. And I think that is the greatest gift that any of us can give ourselves is a balance between the different our different desires and needs in the world.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I really love it. And the science of balance is just so important. We really overemphasize the kind of Helens of the world or the character two parts of us as well. So we're really dominated by that both internally and externally. And so really, obviously, knowing that we have this choice to enter into this inner peace circuitry or to this part of bliss or interconnection or oneness or even just present moment awareness is our choice, which you talk about so beautifully. So, Jill, amazing. What a fascinating journey you have had. We've learned about the 90-second rule, the brain huddle, the four characters of the brain, and it really comes down to this whole brain living and how empowered we can all be by understanding really our neuroanatomy and our neurobiology. And your insights and research into these different aspects are profound, and the combination of your personal knowledge, like what you can really feel about your work, is this knowledge and this storytelling gift that has made it so accessible for all of us. And I'm personally so grateful to you and have enjoyed this conversation so much. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, I'm grateful for the connection of our characters three and four. May we play in the world to create our own increased level of mental and emotional health so that's what we contribute to the world and to one another. So thank you so much for inviting me on your show and for spending this time with me and letting me spend this time with the beautiful characters of your audience.
Oh, thank you so much. And can you please pass our thanks on to Helen also, who...
I absolutely will. You know, no one has ever said that to me. And thank you. Oh, she's just thrilled. She's not just beaming. That's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening today. Don't forget that you can find all the show notes, transcripts, and other resources from today's episode on the FX Medicine website. I'm Dr. Michelle Woolhouse. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
This podcast is intended as healthcare practitioner education only, and it is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to FX Medicine. And share us with your family, friends, and colleagues.